Hermit Slam podcast. I'm Andrew McGregor, and with each installation in this podcast, we're going to explore the world of spirituality, what it means to be alive, and how is it that we can bring our spiritual selves, tarot, meditation, religious or spiritual practices, into our daily lives. Please check out all of our episodes at thehermitslamp.com/podcasts, or you can search The Hermit's Lamp in podcasts on iTunes and download them all directly that way. If you are looking for card-by-card instruction on reading the tarot, please consider checking out James Wells and my new audio project, The Trumps Card-by-Card, where we dig in deep to one of the major cards and explore it thoroughly. If that sounds exactly like what you're looking for and gets your tarot juices all fired up, you can certainly also find that at thehermitslamp.com/podcasts. So welcome back to another episode of The Hermit's Lamp podcast. I'm here with Marcus and Tally of Tarot Professionals this week, and we're going to be discussing history, but not just like the philosophy and theory of history or the mythology that so many people bring up around the cards, but actually discovering, exploring, and unveiling history. So for people who might not be familiar with the two of you, why don't you just give us a quick introduction of who you are?
Okay, so my name is Marcus Katz. I'm the author of Tarosophy and co-author with Tolly Goodwin here of Around the Tarot in 78 days. we could do this all in stereo, actually. Tarot face to face?
Yeah, tarot face to face.
What else have we written?
Lots.
Learning Wand, Abiding in the Sanctuary, After the Angel, Tarot Twist, Tarot Inspire, Tarot Turn, which was a crowdsourced thing, Tarot Inspire. We like Tarot Inspire. The Tarot Life series, the 12 books of the Tarot Life series, mm-hmm. and probably some of the stuff that we've forgotten because we wrote it 3 months ago. And the forthcoming, what's the next one?
Secrets of the Weight, Smith Tarot.
Yeah, Secrets of the Weight, Smith Tarot, which will be out.
I'm Marcus Katz and Tally Goodwin.
Yeah.
You guys are super productive, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's sort of hard to keep up with it all.
We're
creating so much.
We're actually writing as we're talking as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I don't doubt it. So, I mean, when we met face-to-face first time was at the TarotCon in Dallas last year, which would have been 2013. And, you know, the two of you were sort of hot on the trail of Pixie and where Pixie was living and what, you know, what that life might have been like and how Pamela Coleman Smith's engagement with her life and her sense of place made its way into the Rider-Waite-Smith deck. And, you know, I guess I'm curious what it's like to stand in a place and look and be like, I see it. I see that card.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing because we started off on a small line of inquiry and it just unpacked itself in the most incredible ways. We found ourselves at the V&A Museum in the theatre department and the theatre archives, spending a whole day looking through hundreds, if not thousands, of photographs from different actors and actresses.
Yes, that was from the Helen Terry collection.
Yeah. So
which is, you know, really big.
Yeah, it was just
vast amount of photographs and bits
and we didn't know what we were looking for. We just felt that there might be a photograph of Pamela Coleman Smith in all of those photographs, having found other photographs that have not yet been published in our book for the first time, of Pamela Coleman Smith herself, showing her more of a as a person, as a real human being with friends and with connections to people and so on. But
personal life that was, you know.
And we went through maybe over 1,000 photographs over the course of a day, one folder at a time, because you're only allowed to hold one folder at a time. And then you have to replace it back on the shelf and then sign out for the next one.
Mm.
And so we ended up looking through the albums with Tali signing in advance hundreds of forms so that I could keep taking them and opening up the folder, because we only had a day for that particular part of the project. And it's the most frustrating thing to think that you might just miss the most incredible historic photograph because you've got to get back on the train at some point. And that's what perhaps people don't realise about historical research. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort.
Yeah, I can totally get that. I also really like the thing where you said you didn't actually know what you were getting into, and you didn't even really know what you're looking for. You know, and I think that that's fascinating, right?
Yeah.
I think it's because, you know, you actually feel like you are being drawn to it. You know, it's like it is supposed to happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can never overthink it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just got to go with the process.
So let me ask, did you feel Pixie? Did she come around? Did she whisper in your ears? Yeah.
We've had
a
lot of experiences where it has been beyond magical. I think when people see the book, and again, we can't wait to share it. For us, it's old news. It's a project from 2 years ago that we commenced it in all seriousness. But when people see what we've managed to do with it, and what only one person so far has seen the book, and that was nerve-wracking. It was we can't say who it is yet, but we have their feedback that has been presented to us, and you know, I think they've been astonished at what the book contains, because we haven't yet released or revealed some of the really incredible stuff that's in it, the things that answer why the cards are drawn as they are, things that answer who designed the cards, things that answer why the snail is on the Nine of Pentacles, with a photograph, not of the snail, of course, but certainly why the snail is there. And individually, you might be able to guess some of them, but when they're taken together, suddenly it was like Pamela was saying, here's my story, here's my life. It's obvious. Mm. It's obvious why I drew these cards the way I drew them. And both of us had very intense dreams. In fact, at TarotCon, someone, when we first revealed some of this, someone came to us and said that...
That Pamela was actually stood at the back, and that she was behind us, you know, all the way. That was, I know.
And I was a little bit sniffy about that, and you were really, you know, gullible.
Open to things. Open. I tend to be open.
Open. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this lady said.
It's a beautiful thought. Mm-hmm. You know, could be the case.
But the lady said, and she said something
about the shoes.
You have to look at the shoes. Shoes are very important. And I was like,
we do know about the other.
Whatever. Yeah. But then we found a little bit later on, following the same line of research, something very important about the shoes on one of the Wands cards, where the character has mismatched shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is unlaced. It's a shoe that is deliberately drawn to be unlaced, and the other is a boot. And that was the moment we knew that our proposal, which is that Pamela drew the cards based on her Shakespearean background at the time, as well as other things around her, was right, because we found the exact quote for that image, and it was in the shoes.
Yeah.
And that was the moment we knew that was it. We could actually predict that we could find the answer to certain things in the cards from where we were looking, and we were right. At that point, we knew our thesis was right. And so it was in the shoes, and Pamela had told us to look for that. So
I love that, you know, and I think it'll be interesting to see the way in which people's preconceived notions and, sort of pseudo-historical conventions and all of those things get shaken up, you know. I mean, I personally know that the snail is one of the alien overlords from ancient Egypt that transmitted this knowledge through the ethers, right? I mean, isn't this where it comes from?
Well, now you have to be killed.
No, I know the secret handshake. I'm okay. Oh, wait, this is being broadcast. My mistake.
Yeah. We think it will change things, but we don't know how. We think that it should be, we hope it will be a major milestone or turning point in tarot evolution, because it's not about history, it's about the future of tarot. For example, we now know that Pamela Coleman Smith, it was highly unlikely she had ever read tarot. I'll say that again. She had never read tarot. We have no evidence that she ever read it. And it is likely she never went on to read tarot, particularly as she converted to the Catholic faith shortly after the deck was designed. So she only had a few notes from Waite to draw the artwork to. She spent 5 months doing it, and Waite was not interested in the minor cards at all. So Pamela did virtually all of the design work on the minor cards, which explains why Waite said in some cases, oh, it's some hills or perhaps a pyramid in the background. He didn't actually know. He didn't actually care, because 10 years later, when he did his proper tarot deck with Trinnick, he didn't even consider doing the minors because they weren't important to him. So you have a strange, weird Catholic mystic, occultist, hermeticist, who was not interested in fortune telling or using the cards for divination, a soon-to-be Catholic woman artist who had never read tarot and was not that interested in them thereafter, in 5 months created the deck that is now the major model for thousands of tarot decks, and is probably the world's best-selling tarot deck ever, and certainly the most recognised. So when someone comes along and says, I don't know anything about tarot, I'd like to design a deck, I'm going to do it in the next 6 months with a mate of mine who's a Buddhist, then no one should be able to say to them, oh, well, you can't do that, because Pamela didn't do too badly, did she?
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of fact, which is a fact, as far as we understand it, you know, it should be common knowledge. It should be accepted that if they could design a deck like that, then anyone can.
Well, I think that, I mean, I have two thoughts about that. One is, you know, anybody who gets too hegemonic about what tarot is about is, you know, might be on the right track for them, but, you know, in a global perspective, it is really not in the right direction. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, there's 78 cards. There are certain conventions about what those cards are. Beyond that, that's pretty much it. You know, I mean, things go in a lot of radical directions. And, you know, I mean, I've been exploring some of the, you know, the Sola Busca and some of the older decks, and, you know, and you get into these things where it's just radically different. And, you know, and so I think that that's pretty interesting. But the other thing that I think is even more interesting is, you know, and I found this myself in my journey through Thelema and, you know, studying Crowley and that. It's all way more Christian than anybody would like to admit, or than many people would like to admit.
Yeah, we suspect that people will start to refer to the Waitsmith deck as a as the Catholic Shakespeare-themed deck in future, because that's what it is. It's a Catholic, Innistry, mystical, Shakespearean-themed tarot deck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, we know what Waite wanted to design into it but couldn't because it was a public deck. We know what Pamela put into it now and why she put into it what she did. We have one doozy saved for every month for the next 9 months now until the book is released. We're releasing a little teaser on the Facebook group for tarot professionals. And we are working up to one, which is our favourite. It's astonishing because someone said, Westcott actually said about 10 years after Pamela's deck had been published, you know, oh, some woman has designed a deck, but no one can buy it anymore because it's out of print. And then he said that Waite had changed all of the figures and he didn't understand. And he mentioned a couple of very particular cards in the Minor Arcana. And one of them, we have found the source of that image. And it is so, what's the word? Obvious when you look at it. That we can't wait to reveal it, but we're going to reveal that on the very last month before the book's actually published to show people that we now know really what most of the cards mean. Because when you look at what Waite wrote, it doesn't make sense to some of the images. But when you know what Pamela actually designed in the image and why she chose that particular source, it fits the words. So yes, we've got a lot to reveal with the deck.
Well, I'm curious too about the history of the Trinic deck. You know, because there's this other deck that Waite was involved in, right? That technically wasn't ever intended to see the light of day. You know, or at least the you know, the light of most people's computer screens, and yet you know, here it is, you know, a century later or whatever it is exactly, you know, kind of coming to surface. How did you find your way to that? How did you discover that thread and move through it?
Yeah, well, you know, it came about by looking for a photograph of a artist called Wilfred Pipit, and actually looking for that photograph, I came across the Trinic work
in the British Museum.
Yes, in the British Museum. So you know, all these things just seem to fall into place.
yeah.
in a totally natural way. Mm. You know, and yeah.
I think it was one of those weird yeah. things because I received some images of the deck. I mean, I'd actually seen an image from that tarot about 10 years previously at a conference, at an academic conference, and a contact of mine sort of showed it me on his computer screen like, oh, you'll never guess what I have. And it was the Hanged Man from the Trinity deck. And this tends to happen. Collectors and people in the know, people talk about secret societies, but there are genuinely still living secret societies of people who have access to information and archives and so forth that have never seen the light of day. They're not in public libraries and so forth or museums. In fact, some of the Golden Dawn material in our book with Derek Bain, The Origins of the Golden Dawn Tarot, that has over 100 photographs from the Golden Dawn archives that have never been seen before, and about 20 photographs from somebody's back room with pictures of Westcott's tarot deck and things like this, which, again, have never been seen. Mm. So we had an inkling that these cards existed, these images existed, and I found some through a strange series of coincidences. And we knew Trinnick's magical name. And that was just in the background when Tali was searching for Wilfred Pippet, who was a character who I felt was associated with those cards. So when Tali was looking, she actually found it under Trinnick's magical name in the British Museum. Hmm. And you emailed me at about 3 o'clock,
in the morning.
Yeah, so yeah. I woke up.
I'm not obsessive, you see, once I get to looking. I can't stop.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I just carry on and on and on, and I just look and look and look. And that's how I do it, really.
Yeah. So so you sent me an email that said I think I found the whole album of Trinnick's original artwork that's been in the British Museum for 34 years. Should we go and look at it? So
to which you said, I don't know.
Maybe if there's time.
Yeah, maybe next year.
Yeah, so we're on very good terms with the British Museum and the British Library and various other institutes.
Helpful people now, aren't they, really?
Yeah. And they're very keen because, yeah. I mean, we spend...
Because we pay them to, you know, yeah, we, these images.
Yeah. Mm. We had a crowdfunding campaign for the Trinnick images just to pay for the photography. Excuse me. But that didn't pay for the licences.
No,
so it was something like £3,000. That's about $7,000 for the photography. And then it was something like $200 an image. Mm-hmm. And because we wanted... we weren't going to stop until we had all of the images in the book. Mm-hmm. So we went without food for... was it two Christmases, something like that, for a very long time?
It's one way to lose weight. Just in time for the next Christmas.
Yeah. But we spent thousands and thousands of pounds on the book, on Abiding in the Sanctuary, just for 250 copies. We sold out of those very quickly, and then we swore we'd never do it again. People asked for a paperback, so we now have a paperback, and again we had to call it pretty close with the British Museum with paying for more license fees, because people might think the books make money, but they might wonder why an academic book with one photograph in it sells for, you know, £80 or £120, and why most tarot books don't have many images in them, you know, not researched images or historic images or so forth, it's because it costs a lot of money.
Mm.
A lot of money. And to have about 100 colour photographs from the British Museum in one book, it cost us, I'd say, I think we estimated something like about $20,000 in total with the research time and things like that.
Well, that's the thing that always kind of sticks in my craw a bit when people come around, you know. I mean, because as you both know, I run this store, right? And, you know, somebody came in the other day and they're like, you know, they're wanting to learn more about tarot, and I talked to them a little bit about it, and became apparent that that their knowledge base wasn't particularly deep, which, you know, no criticism, right? I mean, people are where they're at, right?
To start somewhere.
Yeah. And I was like, well, you know, you might want to check this out, or here's a really good book, and, you know, if you're working with these kinds of decks, you might want to check out, you know, Yov's book or one of these things. And they're like, oh, well, you know, I can get all that stuff for free online. But they had just finished telling me that they actually couldn't afford their internet connection anymore. And I was just like, I'm like, well, sure. You know, you smile and nod, but I'm like, and they're like, you know, information wants to be free. It was what they kind of rolled out. And I'm like, yeah, you know, but everything costs money, you know. I mean, everything costs something. And, you know, it's very difficult to kind of justify that. And, you know, like you say, the British Museum doesn't just hand out stuff for
give
free.
It away, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's not like you could take them down to the photocopier room, right, and throw them on the photocopier and put in your, you know, your quarter or what have you, and, you know, crank out some copies, you know?
Well, actually, somebody did recently, excuse me, based on Mary Greer's research, we went down to the British Museum to find out if the coffee cards, the amusements de Allemande, actually had a booklet with them. And Mary had discovered these cards, which were definitely precursors to the Game of Hope, which we'd unearthed ourselves in the British Museum about 3 years ago, based on the work of Professor
Hoffman,
the unfortunately recently departed Professor Hoffman, who died with a wealth of information on Le Normand and other cards still in his head, unfortunately. So we went down to the museum. We requested the images, and they got them out for us, these cards in a pack, and there was a booklet with them. We opened up the booklet, and the very first thing we saw was, these are called the coffee cards because they are based on coffee grinds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first written evidence that anyone has ever had that the Le Normand symbols come from coffee grind symbols. And, you know, we were really delighted. We published a little booklet. We transcribed everything ourselves. And the next thing that happened, of course, is...
typed it up, yes.
Yeah, we typed it up. You typed it all up.
That's why I've got a bad shoulder. too much
typing. But the British Museum, whilst the images were out, took advantage and photographed them. Now, we didn't pay for the photography in this particular case, thank God, because within a month, everybody was saying, oh, there's no need to buy that little booklet that they've done because you can see all of the text now on the British Museum, which is fine, which is great. However, somebody downloaded the images of the cards and started to publish them themselves and offered them on various Facebook groups. And when we said, we think this is probably illegal, they said, well, the British Museum have no right to hold a copyright on images of that age. And they cited some strange,
obscure sort of case.
Court case. Now, that's all well and good if they want to take that to court with the British Museum. Now, we told the British Museum, not because we wanted to tell tales, which is how it got depicted, but because we work with them.
And we pay them.
And we pay them a lot of money. And at some point they might do what the Warburg do with Crowley's material, which is restrict access to it because it's being abused. And we don't want that to happen. So these people who are, as you say, you know, releasing information or that information should be free, they are not the ones having to pay for rent of the museum in London and the staff to look after the images.
And all of that work to keep these old, old things safe for as long as they possibly can, right? Because, you know, I mean, little paper books don't last, right? You know, I mean, that's not going to endure in my basement very well.
Yeah, and every time we handle these materials, like the Trinnick materials, I mean, I once opened a book in the Royal Society archives of fortune wheels, an old Italian book, and the cover fell off in my hand. And I quickly placed it back. And then I called the assistant over and said, can you take this book out of its box for me? And he lifted the book as I'd done, and the cover came off in his hands, of course, because I pulled it off. And he looked at me really shocked, and I said, oh, it's okay, I won't mention it. And we have this little secret between us.
It fell off, actually, didn't it?
It fell off. I didn't actually
pull it off.
No.
It fell off with that age.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like Indiana Jones goes into the Temple of Doom just to break stuff up. And then...
Well, you know, every time you talk about being in the British Museum, I have to say I think of Indiana Jones, you know? And when I think of your adventures, I'm picturing you both wearing that hat and the leather vest and, you know, being like strutting through town.
Well, it sometimes feels more like Dan Brown than Indiana Jones. In fact, because of the stained glass work for the Trinnick work and for something that we have saved in secret for the Pamela Coleman Smith work, it is sometimes, as I think you open with a question, what is it like to stand there and be in the places that hold these secrets?
Special feeling. It really is a special feeling
It is incredible sometimes to suddenly look up and see something that you know your quarry, your prey, your protagonist, your the ghost or spirit that is calling you has placed there or saw or has taken a message from or has turned into a tarot card. And you're stood there and you hear them. You hear that communication and you make a connection and it's just unreal. And it's more than real, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's,
I remember a friend of mine
makes sense.
Handed me a first edition of True and Faithful Recollection from John Dee and Edward Kelly, you know? And, you know, holding the a first edition of that book, you know, I was just, I was all about that Enochian work at the time that he was showing it to me, you know? And, you know, it's just, it's like you can feel the energy of the beings and the book. And, you know, I was just like, I wanted to take it, hold it to my forehead and be like, transfer a little of that wisdom into me, please, you know?
I think it's so important because, you know, the reality is always more magical and astonishing than the myths. And the idea that Waite sat down with Pamela Coleman Smith and designed Freemasonic mysteries and Grail stories and half embedded it within the card so that no one for a century would ever somehow notice it, and yet it would be there. People don't put secrets into images unless they want to communicate the secret. And, you know, that's why those proposals for the deck have never worked out. They're not commonly accepted. You can't look at the deck and say, oh, that's definitely this, 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 and this in that sequence. You know, one of the cards will sort of fall out of that sequence, or you'll have to half inch your explanation, or, you know, come up with something even more obscure. But the actual reality of standing, like when we found the two photos out of those 1,000 photos in the V&A Museum of Ellen Terry's life, and found two images, one of which we thought we might find, sort of, and the other answered a question about the Six of Swords. We didn't know which boat it was on the Six of Swords, but then we had a picture of that boat, and it's in the book. Yeah. And to actually then go, that was real. Pamela had someone stand there and model for that card in the place she was living. And that place doesn't exist anymore. That boat doesn't exist anymore. But if you go back to 1909 and stand there with all of these records, then you see what she saw. You see what Pamela saw and how she was living. And that's far more magical than pretending it's some strange grail myth that, I mean, we know Pamela Coleman Smith's phone number.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, we could give her a call.
Yeah,
excellent. You know, I'm hearing a seance in the future, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it isn't 666-777 or anything.
Well, it's always simpler, though, isn't it? Like, I mean, it's one of the things that I'm hearing in your story, and it's certainly one of the things that mirrors my experience. It's always more simple and more beautiful and more magical than we imagine it to be, because at least for me, these elaborate things, they don't really carry a lot of stuff that I can hold on to and that moves me. Mm. They just become these elaborate thought forms as opposed to an actual sense of connection.
Yeah, they're a bit contrived, you know, really contrived. And
we had a rule while we were writing The Secrets, which was we had a little slogan above our writing desk where we sit opposite each other when we're writing, and we'd simply written, "What did Waite write?" Question mark. And we used that as a touchstone whilst we were writing the book, which is, if we suddenly started to talk about a card, we would stop ourselves and go back to, what did Waite write? What did Pamela draw? Have we seen that place? Do we know if that actress lived at that time? Would Pamela have gone to see that actress? Was she in London when that play was on? And we rigorously held to that. There's a couple of photos that might be of Pamela, but we can't be absolutely certain because they don't have a handwritten note say, this is Pamela Coleman Smith, by someone who took the photo at the time. So we haven't included those in the book. And, the ones we have included in the book, I think, tell an interesting story about Pamela and her life. A sad one, I think.
Yes, sad towards the end.
Yeah.
It's often the case, isn't it?
The only person.
You know, I mean, I look at the life of a lot of the mystics, you know, and they often kind of have these sort of sad ends towards their life, you know? What do you think? Why do you think that's the case?
I think it's because it's when you are an outsider, you know, sorry, I'm stammering again, like Pamela, and of course, us, you know, we're all, outsiders. Life is that much harder, and it is, and it's harder to be accepted by the. Sorry, I'm stumbling again. Establishment, you know.
Yeah. I think as
and
well.
I think it was hard for her, wasn't it? You
know, it was really hard for because, Pamela. Yeah. Again, we have some images in the book. I think the one that gets me most is Tali found all of the shipping records as part of her research. And so that we knew exactly where Pamela was travelling, when she was travelling, who she was travelling with, and so forth. And we have her signature and records of her passage between different places, some of which you can get online, but a lot of the stuff that's online is wrong. And so we deliberately didn't touch any of the online research at all. We're aware of it, and some of it's very good, but we went back. Have we held that document? Have we seen that document? And one of the shipping records on one of the tours, the Lyceum tours, with Bram Stoker. With Bram Stoker and Ellen Terry and a few other characters. Who were important in Pamela's life. The shipping record has all of their names. It has their role, you know, set designer, actor, actress, musician, stagehand, and so on. And it goes on for two pages, and it has a little cross mark next to each of them for their nationality. And it's a solid line of two pages with one little... difference. On Pamela's line,
alien.
It just says alien.
Because, you know, because they're all British or the rest of the...
They're all English or... and it's British. Pamela who is the alien. Even in that crowd who were the bohemian set, Pamela was alien. And you can just see it on the page. It's like, you know, you're normal, or you're weird normal. You're just completely alien. And we think she played up to that. We have some remarkable letters of hers that, again, haven't been published before. And it really, you know, she really did play this sort of childlike mystic. Because that's what got her business. People liked that sort of thing. The gallery owners, people like Stieglitz, they were after these strange mystical creatures who spoke of the other worlds. And that can get you so far.
And then it tends to wear thin after a while.
It either works out really well or you're Picasso drawing something on a napkin to pay your bill at the restaurant, right? It's a Picasso. Get out of here.
And that's it. That's what happened. After a while, it both wore thin. She was... her magical motto in The Golden Dawn was taken from do unto others as you would have done unto you. And if that symbolised her core belief, which you were told to... turn into a motto in The Golden Dawn. So that's a very interesting fact, the fact she chose her magical motto to represent her primary core belief. She must have been terribly disappointed and let down and betrayed, perhaps, by her so-called friends.
And,
so she turned to the Catholic faith, which she'd been flirting with for a while, and we have one last record of her... of someone visiting her and saying, oh, she doesn't have any of her old friends. She has all of these new Catholic friends and...
they were boring.
And they're very boring. And that was it. She then vanished. She went to live down in Cornwall. She ran some sort of hostel for priests. She got into trouble with the local press for putting a big cross outside the house.
Painting on the
walls.
It's a big painting, fresco.
And died in probably a pauper's grave that is now built over with a housing estate. Her remaining life story we are interested in, but haven't had time to go and explore, because we have to go down and visit the library there. We have to go through hundreds of thousands of newspapers. There is no way someone could have lived there for almost 30 years and not left a trace or a footprint.
It's very strange. So it must be there.
I guess it just depends on how banal her life was, too, right? I mean, aside from the fricus about the, you know, the cross and stuff like that, you know, I mean, I think about the people who I live, you know, I live in a building with a bunch of different people, and I know many of them quite well, and some of them are very public. I mean, they're all lovely people. Some of them are very public, and one would easily find a trace, and some of them probably never, you know, because they get up, they go to work, they take care of their kids, they do this, they do that, and there's nothing that would encourage lasting marks in the records in that kind of way.
Yeah, it's interesting because you know as researchers and authors we have to decide whether we want to follow that line of research or not, and you know we've talked about it and people have asked us about it, but we don't feel called to it in the same way as her story up to the tarot.
Yeah.
We really do feel that needed to be told, and she wanted it to be told, or she wouldn't have minded it being told. I guess we're still on the elusive hunt for 78
paintings
in somebody's attic. But we happen to know something about that in the sense of...
Don't tell.
They're in your basement, aren't
that's
they?
That's the real
right
secret
now?
Of the weight.
So what's that on the wall behind you? Is that a print? Is that...
if only. But there's the thing, you see. If we had 78 paintings, original paintings by Pamela Coleman Smith of those tarot cards, you could be bet they'd be on social media by now. You can bet that we'd have a larger eBay auction. No, we're not that mercenary, but... they were, and there's the thing. Mm. If Pamela or Waite had have still had those paintings, they would have sold them, and there would be a public record of that sale in some way or another. It would have been known, because they were often poverty-stricken after that time. And although the deck wasn't, strangely, it wasn't that popular, for a while, they sold at least three printings of it, but within 12 years we have records of it being out of print. And then it didn't really resurface until the 60s, long after she died, or comparatively after she died. So if she'd have had paintings, she would have sold them. There'd be a public auction, and there'd be someone would have them, and they wouldn't have kept it a secret for this long. So our suspicion is, unfortunately, the paintings have just gone by the by at some point. Because at the time, they weren't that interested in it. That's the thing, and it's why we must never, ever judge our projects on our current lifetime. Because they certainly had no idea what would become of that 5 month project that they didn't really care about.
Yeah.
Not really. They moved on from it. And, Waite mentions Pamela in his autobiography, Shadows of Life and Thought, as a sort of, project worker for a while, but that's it. Pamela didn't think, I could make money by doing, the Coleman Smith revised deck.
You see that, right? I mean, Crowley, the way Crowley talks about Harris, right? You know, I mean, it's not, obviously she contributed a lot, right? I mean, she made all of those beautiful images. I've seen his original artwork. It wouldn't still be in print, you know. No matter how interesting it is, it's not beautiful. It doesn't speak outside of a certain frame of reference, and so there's this long history too, right? Of the occultists and their sort of ideas of what's going on, and then the people, often women, who were painting and making the artwork. And you know, it's really fascinating the way there's that sort of separation. And, you know, it's something that when people talk mm-hmm. about Crowley and they're like, oh, well, you know, he was a horrible person and this and that and all those other things that they'd often come up. And I'm like, well, you know, but they still feel drawn to the deck. I'm like, well, if it makes you feel better, think of it as the Lady Frieda Harris deck, you know? I mean, it was painted by this woman and maybe you can separate it, you know?
Yeah, I think Ferez has been fascinating as well from a contemporary point of view, because we started designing the deck just before we started working on this particular book. Yeah. And so we've been working with an artist, Janine Hall, in Canada, of course, on that. And it took us about a year to work out a sort of communication or a language that has settled into place.
Mm.
And, you know, I send my sketches and Tali comes up with her visionary ideas. You know, I want an angel carrying its own wings, walking to an ark that's flooding from the inside out as all of creation floods into it. And, oh, by the way, the angel is turning into stone as it looks back. And I want the blood falling from its shoulders to form the roses that we see in some of the other cards as the divine made manifest. And I write that down. I send it to the artist and Janine sends back a sketch. And we're like, we're going to have to think bigger.
She's an amazing artist.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She can paint whatever we can vision. And then suddenly you realise that what's going to happen is we're going to be judged on, is that all you could imagine? This is the constraints of the whole of your visionary experience, because the artist is capable of manifesting that.
Well, and at the same time, too, it's, you know, I've started in earnest the creation of my next deck, which basically just consists of a whole lot of ideas flowing into folders in Evernote, right? Because at the same time, there comes a point at which the paint must hit the paper and the thinking has to stop. And so, you know, that thinking it out, that looking at it, that exploring the ideas, and then the kind of laying it down and trusting that process is so difficult. And that's just me. I'm going to do all the painting, right? So when you're like looking at somebody else and getting them to reflect back to you and, you know, whatever their artistic and other interpretations on top of it, it's so complicated, right?
Yeah, and then
it's
the artist comes.
It's a good way of working, though, isn't it? When you
it is a great way of working, and because Janine can come back, and I guess this is the case in all cases. The artist can come back and have something where it just blows you away because it's so different but better than what you had in your own head, or it blows you away because it's exactly the same as you had in your own head, or you look at it and go, "Oh no, I hate it. That isn't what I meant at all." And you have to work with the artist to actually say, "I know you've spent a month expensive oil painting in this case to create this sublime vision, but I don't like it. Can you do it again?" And of course, Crowley and Harris had that dialogue a lot.
Sure.
You know, he made her do some of the cards 4 or 5 times.
I just saw that there's a new collection out of writings, and Richard Kaczynski has an essay in it which has 8 drawings of the Magus card, right? You know?
Exactly. Yeah, that's in the Tarot in Culture anthology by edited by Emily Auger, and Richard's article in that is incredible, absolutely a must-have for Thoth enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it has all of those sketches of the Magus card.
Yeah, well, I think about just, you know, when I did my tarot Waiting to Happen, so many of the cards, you know, I mean, it's the majors only, right? And probably 18 of those cards emerged really quickly. And then the other ones were just these, like, back and forth, and this is wrong, and all, you know, and just over and over and over again. It's amazing how sometimes they don't want to reveal themselves to you, it seems, you know?
Totally dry up, don't they?
I think
then it's interesting from a contemporary point of view to look at the history of tarot and its design, because people drew these cards and they drew them for very different reasons. They created the artwork for very different reasons. The Visconti Sforza deck was a sort of family token of, look, we can have gold quilted playing cards that no one would ever dare shuffle, but aren't we rich enough to have, you know, and come into the bathroom where we've just had these gold gilt taps and toilet roll holders installed. They weren't divinatory objects. And then you will have someone like Rachel Pollack, who her Shining Tribe tarot, which is, I found completely alien until I saw Rachel using them constantly in a dialogue with the universe. And, you know, there's someone who literally talks tarot to and from the universe through the cards that she has created using that model. And, you know, every single person, I think, should design their own tarot deck. We were asked recently about the future of tarot. And one of our predictions, and, you know, we'll say it's here on the record so we can come back to it and find out how horribly wrong we were or how unimaginative we were because of what really did happen. Or how right we were, and then we'll get, I don't know, a biscuit or something.
You'll get an end note.
An end note, excellent. Which is this. We think that tarot decks will become increasingly individual. And by that we mean everyone will have their own deck. The age of, oh, do you have an Etelia deck or an Olympus tarot or a Golden tarot or Waitsmith tarot will pass into, oh, your deck's cool. Look at my deck.
Personalised decks.
Whether those decks are like almost kit form decks where you have some cards the same as other people or some designs the same, and how that actually manifests. Will it be almost automated? Will everyone find an artist to do their deck for them? Will that become cheaper? Printers have become cheaper. Will it be 3D printed? But the actual mechanism of producing a deck is now in the hands of every individual. And we're seeing this already with how many crowdsourced decks have we seen in the last 2 months? And how many are we promoting at the moment? At least two live ones. And those are people who have now the ability to mass publish their own deck.
Well, you bring that up, and it actually I'll pull a Marcus and Tally and make a first time announcement here. You heard it here first. Starting in September, my new project that I'm doing with people is I'm alternating between calling it a tarot of you or an oracle of yourself, which is I'm going to, for people who are interested, take them through a 6-month process of creating a majors or equivalent out of themselves and out of their own journey and out of a process. So not just like, as you say, not just, well, now what's your fool like, but like out of a process of taking people through themselves and their history and their issues and their dreams and so on. And then at the end of that, we will use one of these printing services to print them a copy of their own deck that they can then use with themselves, on themselves, for themselves, or in whatever way they like, because it'll all be specific, contextual, historical. And you don't need a book for that at that point, right? It's like, oh, this is the card of my childhood safe place. This is the card of other things, you know? So...
You see, we predicted it, and now it's happening. It's happening right now, people. And you heard it here first.
The tarot is now. The tarot is now.
And the tarot is yours as well. I mean, we got asked a question today on our Facebook group. Does the association cater for intuitive readers? And I mean, we answered the question very seriously, but we're always totally...
We are all intuitive.
Yeah.
You know, in some way or something.
It's the idea that even an association would somhow regiment, restrict, monopolize, or have any ability to somehow shape the diversity of divination. That ain't going to happen. Mm-hmm. And tarot is, as Tali said once, you know, it's a blank Bible. And people can write into it their own spirituality.
And that's what, yeah.
As you're going to be doing with the people you take through that process.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, I mean, hopefully not many people will note this, but our Tarot Life series has a secret in the 11th book. As people have worked through all 11 months, the 11th book reveals the big secret, because the series has been out a while now, which is that all 11 books are generating experiences that allow the person in the 11th book to create, if they wish, their own tarot deck.
Mm-hmm.
So experiences that they had with their dream work in month 3 of the book series are then brought into theming their deck in the 11th book. Yeah. So it's an extended version of what you're doing. And I would guess that's going to happen more and more. People are going to want to create their own deck and not be beholden to not just particular deck styles or artwork, but actual models, philosophical models, reading methods. I think we are on a major tipping point. And it's going to be fascinating to see what happens in the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. And we should come back to this this audio. And
times are changing in tarot, aren't they?
Yeah, very much.
Well, I think we should come back in a year and see what's changed. Because I think, never mind yes. 10 years. And I mean, in 10 years, podcasting might not even exist anymore, right? But, you know, in a year, I think it'd be interesting to come back and review what's going on.
Absolutely.
So we're reaching the end of our time here. And I mean, I could sit and chat with you guys all day. This is just delightful. But one of the things that I did want to talk about, is these conferences, right? You know, we're doing a conference next year in Toronto, and you've got a variety of different things going on around the world. And, you know, it's fascinating to me because, number one, getting to meet people in person is astounding. You know, it's so different, right, to get to sit down with somebody. And the thing that you'll realize if you make it to, you know, any of the TarotCon events or any of the other events, because there's so many different things going on all over the world, right? We can't even begin to point at them all. Is, you know, people show up and, you know, you have these notions that, like, oh, it's, you know, it's Mary Greer. Oh, it's this person. Everybody's just people, you know. Everyone is just generally so nice, so friendly, so open. You just sit down and have coffee and chat with people. You do all these great conference events too, but it's all that sort of getting to meet people and know people that's so wonderful as well.
Yeah, I think for us, we really, when we first set up the association, again, that was 6 years ago now, and the world was a very different place. I mean, social media really hadn't took off. Mm. It was about to, and hence, you know, the association taking off with it. But, you know, people were still on Yahoo chat groups and things like that. In fact, one of the tarot list serves was still active at that point. But we really wanted to bring together artists and philosophers and professional designers and academics and down and dirty gypsy tarot readers and put them in a room and see what happened. Because at that point, it was very, very segmented, massively segmented, and very small in each of those various communities. And at Dallas TarotCon, our first US TarotCon, because we'd been running the UK one for about 3 years at that point, I looked out the window and I grabbed Tali and I took a photo and I said, this is it. Because outside...
Yes, I remember now.
Around the table, there was Art Rosengarten, Dan Pelletier, Enrique Enriquez, and Bob Place. Now, first of all, it was notable because they were all men, and 80% of the people in tarot are women. But the other thing was there was an artist, a deck seller, a psychologist, and a poet all around the table with an academic and author taking a photo of them. So that was it. That was the moment that we built the tarot cons for. Now, the UK one, we're receiving registrations as we speak. We had two again this morning. We think the UK one, which is its sixth year now, is going to be the biggest tarot event in the UK this year. And obviously we've announced several of the new ones in the US and the Toronto one as well in Canada for next year. But actually we've got far wider plans than that. And the best thing is that every speaker gets to travel, not just within their state, but internationally. So we've just bought the ticket for Russell Sturgis. hence our lack of food today, to bring him across from Australia to the UK event. Obviously, we have James coming from Canada for the UK event this year. But that's just the first stage of what we originally planned with the Tarot Cons, which is to have international speakers travelling around the circuit, just like in any other profession or any other academic pursuit or any other practical pursuit. You know, even plumbers get to hear plumbers from different countries at various plumber cons, I would imagine. I mean, I would imagine there's a plumber con. I'm going to Google that.
Excellent. Yes. I want to see what their poster looks like, you know?
I can already see the
There's
poster.
There's a theme there with plums and plumbing.
Yeah. You see, our marketing director is already at work on the strap line. What would the tagline be? You have 2 seconds.
Just don't go there, please.
Oh, that'd be the tagline. Just don't go there. And the toilet. PlumberCon 2013.
You are plumbing the depths of...
plumb the depths. It's, okay, there we go. Again, you heard it here first. Our next venture, PlumberCon 2015, plumb the depths of piping. Okay, we're giving up on tarot now. There's an emerging market in plumbing that we have to go and conquer.
And then from that, you can segue into Lovecraftian horror. You know, it'll be perfect. You got like several careers lined up all at once here.
Brilliant. Anyhow, so yes, but the tarot cons are important because when people come, there's a barrier to entry that people think it's going to, like you say, that they might be out of their depth or it's a long way to go or whatever. I mean, they should try the 30-hour trip from the UK to Australia if they think it's a long way to go. Yeah. But when you're there and when people are there, I can tell you one thing, they always... And we always want to come back because of the experience. You can't replicate that on social media, no matter how much you try.
And, you know, I mean, like I'll speak for myself. This is both from my experience on either side of this, you know. I was at an event in Toronto and somebody was, you know, got me as their partner and was like, oh, I'm really nervous. I'm like, why? Like, just say whatever. Whatever comes to mind, it's good. And, you know, that experience of getting to work with people who can just be encouraging, and everybody is encouraging, you know, and everybody was, you know, at some other point, at some point in the past, whether recently or long past. And, you know, everybody has something to offer, and everybody's insights are helpful. And, you know, it's not about being right in the way that people are afraid that it is, I think.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for professionals, it's good because, you know, generally speaking, most of the book deals and deck deals and things like that are usually done face-to-face in a little side room to one of the tarot cons. You know, it's like, have you got 10 minutes? We'll talk about the thing we've been emailing about for the last 8 months. And when you actually sat with somebody, that's when you know that you can work with them, that, you know. But for absolute beginners, our general experience is that they come away from a tarot con and, you know, they've learned more about tarot in 2 days than they'll be able to process in the next 6 months.
And just like you said with Rachel Pollack's deck, the value of seeing somebody do what they do is it can't be expressed enough, you know, because there's like lots of people. I remember the workshop on shadow stuff that we did in Dallas, you know, and just watching that and listening to Gina talk, and, you know, just Gina Thies doing the workshop, and, you know, it's just, it inspired me, and it is continuing, you know, whatever it is, creeping up on a year later, to inform and inspire my personal work around working with the cards. So, you know, these things, the way in which you can see stuff that other people are doing or thinking, and it's kind of like touching the original book or deck or whatever. There's some kind of transference that transcends what just reading it or looking at it might do for you.
Planting the seeds.
It is an interesting segue into what we've just been talking around in the other segment about history. The fact that we felt Pamela calling for her story to be told. Mm. With contemporary events, like the Tarot Con, I can hear Gina talking when I read her book. And that really enriches the experience.
Yeah.
And so similarly, even after 30 years of being into tarot and you know, going through phases of being bored with it or thinking that there's no good new ideas or it's reached a plateau, I was blown away with, say, Enrique Enriquez's work and his sort of poetic style. But I just didn't understand the whole surrealist context in which that arose. And, you know, he wouldn't mind me saying this because I talked to him about it. I just thought it was, you know, overly intellectual, very pretentious and so forth. And Enrique said one thing at the conference, just as a side thing, which was surrealism is also a political movement in that it is designed to free the mind so that if someone says to you March, you say April. And
then it all fell into place for you. Then,
yeah, I turned around to Tali and I was just, my face just went flat and 1,000 things started to fall into place inside my head that I really suddenly felt, I think I understand that. I get that. Yeah. And that changed my whole approach and attitude to discovering now all sorts of things. I've been reading a book recently on surrealist games. And in bringing that into Tarotsophy. You know, those events when people just say something that can literally change, not quite change your whole life, but certainly send you into whole new enriching areas of life. I think it's invaluable. And you can't get that online.
No.
Online is flat and linear. Real life isn't.
Well, you know, there's a saying that I'm very fond of, 10 minutes with a wise person is better than reading 100 books. And, you know, I think that, you know, the same could be said, 10 minutes with somebody wise might be better than 1,000 hours of Facebook, you know.
I think 1 minute with a real human being is worth an infinite amount of time. Sat in front of a computer screen, imagining that you are virtually connecting. It's good for information, but you need to do something with your life with that information. And, you know, but that's a whole other area.
That's a whole other thing.
Show, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, let's put an end to it there as we're an hour and 15 minutes into our lovely chat. Where's the best place for people to connect with the two of you or individually online? Where might they find you?
I think the best place is www.tarotassociation.net. And
there's a wasp here, I'm afraid to say.
And it's the height of summer here at the time of live recording. We have the window open in our library here, and there's a wasp flying around saying, finish. And to find us on Facebook. The site at the moment on Facebook, which has, at the time of live recording, 12,500 people on the discussion group, is under Tarot Professionals. But it may well be under Tarot Association when we convince Facebook that we really exist.
Well, I'll put a link in the show notes, and we can find it. And if you are going to come and participate in that great big group on Tarot Association or on Facebook, please jump in. Please say things. Please say hello. Please ask questions, and really, the group is wonderful, most of the time, like many things, right? And, just jump in and say hi and talk and ask questions and post stuff and then listen to what feels right from the answers and put the rest aside. Can you imagine 12,000 people giving you an answer to your question? You got to sort it, right? but there's some great conversations that happen there.
Yeah, so. quite often, Rachel Pollack, Mary Greer, Shiro Marchetti, and ourselves are all trying to beat each other to come up with a clever answer to a newbie question. And the person there is sort of saying, I can't believe it, there's authors. But we're real people. And, we love questions because that's where we start everything from is the questions. And it's where every reading starts from as well.
And I think maybe I'll end it with this. And we're all outsiders. We're all aliens. And we're all looking to connect too, because the longer we journey, and I hear this from the people, decades down the line, and I experience it myself. The longer you journey on this road with tarot, with mysticism, with spirit, it becomes separating in ways. And it becomes harder within arm's reach of our lives often to connect with people and so on. And I think that this is the truth of all of these people. And, we're all looking to connect. And so come and connect, come and play, come and be human, come be part of what's going on. So since recording this podcast, I have indeed created a whole page and a 6-minute video on this process that I've been discussing a little bit here on creating a tarot of you. Drawing imagery from your life, from your dreams, through working with me to help create a custom, unique to you tarot deck that will help you more easily navigate yourself and your journey and get you into a deeper relationship with yourself. And of course, reveal a whole lot to you about the cards in general along the way. So please jump over to thehermitslamp.com/tarotofyou. All one word, to check out all the details. And please don't let any crazy notion that you're not an artist or creative get in the way of doing something wonderful and exciting. At least go check it out, because in my opinion, everybody's an artist. So head on over to thehermitslamp.com/tarotofyou.